Chapter 3. Medicine, Revenge of the Chronic. So far, we have seen two kinds of revenge effects of medical technology. The first is that non-medical technological change appears to have done more for human health than medical procedures. The second is that more advanced procedures and drugs demand a higher level of craft skills and impose a burden of greater attention, contrary to most expectations of technological change. But these hardly account for the health anxieties of people with excellent access to medical care. One explanation, advanced by Ivan Illich and other critics, is that physicians and other professionals are manipulating demand, promoting dependency on themselves. It was in this spirit that the Viennese writer Karl Kraus once defined psychoanalysis as, quote, the disease of which it purports to be the cure, unquote. This line of attack has some merit, but cannot explain why so many people ask for more treatment than practitioners want to provide. Professionals dread the hard core of complainers, the turkeys who haunt emergency rooms. Physicians do realize, however, that millions of people without easily diagnosed complaints are really in pain, and these patients' ailments have turned out to elude the strengths of medical technology. Whereas drugs and procedures target specific local problems, individual symptoms are often vague. Headaches, fatigue, pain, digestive problems. And while X-ray and magnetic resonance devices at first seem to have revealed the body's innermost secrets, now scans and tests all too often reveal nothing unusual. Surgery, having saved countless patients, now often, it seems, can do little. The illnesses we used to worry most about were visible, local, and relatively brief. Now they are elusive, polymorphous, and open-ended. Medical technology can manage some chronic conditions, but sometimes only with serious side effects. It can deflect the acute phases of others, prolonging life. But after a century of brilliant successes with specific treatments, medicine today must come to terms with the very conception that it thought it could do without: the patient as a whole system. The rediscovery of chronic illness. Early in the 20th century, hospital-based physicians avoided chronic cases as discouraging and intellectually unpromising. But as the sociologist and historian of medicine, Daniel M. Fox, has pointed out, interest in incurable disease began to grow in the 1920s and 1930s. With the apparent conquest of tuberculosis by the late 1940s, TB researchers shifted their work to chronic respiratory diseases. Funding increased steadily for these and for cancer, heart disease, and stroke in the 1950s and 1960s. At that very time, the microbiologist René Dubos, in his book Mirage of Health, stressed not only the limits of the germ theory and the importance of the environment, but the fact that medicines, quote, are far more effective in the dramatic acute conditions which are relatively rare than in the countless chronic ailments that account for so much misery in everyday life, unquote. The epidemiologist Abdel R. Omran put this paradox in a global perspective in a 1971 article titled The Epidemiologic Transition. He argued for a three-stage process of medical development: an age of pestilence and famine, an age of receding pandemics, and an age of degenerative and man-made diseases, with respective average life expectancies at birth of 20 to 40 years, 30 to 50 years, and over 50 years. The West entered the third stage in the 1920s. Omran saw the rise of chronic illness as a positive sign of the banishment of pestilence, famine, and pandemic. He was concerned more with the conditions of social and economic modernization than with the problems of chronic illness in the developed world. But a few years later, another article drew more pessimistic conclusions for industrial countries. In the influential analysis, The Failures of Success, the psychiatrist and epidemiologist Ernest M. Grunberg recalled a paradox still cited in the 1935 edition of William Osler's classic textbook on medicine. Osler had written that, quote, persons rarely die of the disease with which they suffer. Secondary terminal infections carry off many patients with incurable disease, unquote. Yet by the late 1930s, sulfa drugs were cutting the death rate from pneumonia in half, while penicillin and other antibiotics were to reduce it still more in the post-war period. The patients saved by new treatments were disproportionately people already weakened by incurable disease. Instead of improving health, medical research was inadvertently impairing it by increasing the prevalence of disability and chronic illness. Grunberg was also struck by the increase of the proportion of children affected by what is now called Down syndrome. One study revealed that it had doubled in the 20 years after 1929 and had doubled again to 1 in 1,000 by 1958. Another suggested that among children from 5 to 14 years old, the prevalence rate had doubled even between 1961 and 1974. Once, most children with Down syndrome died of pneumonia before the age of 6. By the 1970s, even the diseases of middle age were being successfully treated, and doctors were expecting the first generation of elderly Down syndrome patients. Alzheimer's disease patients also seemed to be surviving twice as long. There was evidence that better treatments for pneumonia, heart attacks, and stroke were letting arterial sclerosis progress further, resulting in more chronic brain, heart, and kidney disease. Grunberg's point was to shift the goals of medical research away from eradicating infections to understanding the mechanisms of chronic and degenerative disease. The discovery that fluorine deficiency contributed to dental caries appeared to show how research could target a widespread chronic disease successfully. Grunberg, a survivor of severe injuries from an automobile accident, recognized that many chronically ill and disabled people could still enjoy a high quality of life. His plea was not to stop saving lives, but to abandon the illusion that reducing mortality rates was the only, or even the main, goal of the public health movement. When medical and public health thinkers rediscovered chronic illness in the midst of post-war medical optimism, they generally passed over a difficult question. How much chronic illness had existed before Amran's epidemiological transition, undiagnosed or even unnamed? While chronic and degenerative illnesses are the cause of death more often than 100 years ago, nobody knows how much more prevalent they really are. A social historian of 18th-century Germany recently mentioned in a seminar a case she had found in an archival document. A woman in intense pain from a bunion saw a physician. She also had cancer, but that was not her chief complaint. She believed, no doubt correctly, that it could not be cured. Meanwhile, the bunion was keeping her from doing necessary work, and it could be treated. In our own time, postmortem necropsy has revealed a much greater incidence of cancer, heart disease, and other silent conditions not listed on death certificates. The multitude of deaths from infectious disease in middle age 100 years ago undoubtedly concealed many chronic conditions. Like the 18th-century cancer patient, the 19th-century quarryman suffering from silicosis, the coal miner from black lung, the cotton mill worker from brown lung, and the asbestos worker from white lung usually had little to gain from reporting chronic occupational illness. Far from receiving workers' compensation or disability payments, a sick worker might become unemployed and unemployable. The success of the germ theory had the revenge effect of delaying recognition of diseases that developed slowly from exposure to environmental insult. Silicosis became a special problem as power tools increased the volume of dust to which workers were exposed. Yet instead of pursuing this link, scientific medical researchers turned their backs on industrial and environmental factors to hunt for disease-specific germs. Until South African commissions established that silicosis was a disease in its own right, European and American medical authorities believed that phthisis, as it was called, was a form of tuberculosis. Even in our own time, it is difficult to diagnose silicosis, x-rays are unreliable, and the authors of the Standard History of the Disease insist it remains widely underreported. Already in the late 19th century, the observation of a 1950s miners' union official must have applied. It's a grim joke in mining camps that miners never die of silicosis. That's because silicosis brings on tuberculosis or heart failure or some kind of infection. You will find these other diseases on the records, but without the silicosis, they wouldn't have occurred. Even conditions like chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, and carpal tunnel syndrome, CTS, recently named and linked to the new stresses of 20th century life, had precursors. English clerks of the early 19th century first reported a writer's cramp affecting the thumb, forefinger, and middle finger, and arising in the same kind of stressful, white-collar environment as today's CTS. We know less about possible 19th-century blue-collar CTS, possibly because the processes of the time did not expose workers to the same risks. The vapors of the same period, and the later 19th-century diagnosis of neurasthenia, were applied to a cluster of symptoms similar to chronic fatigue syndrome, exhaustion, multiple pains, fevers, and depression. The similarity is attractive to psychiatrists and psychologists favoring psychological and social, as opposed to viral or other organic, explanations for CFS. But it is equally possible that a virus causing CFS has been active continuously or intermittently for a century or more, and that cultural change only led more patients to report it as a disease. Infectious diseases must have masked many hidden chronic conditions, which in turn may have affected the rate of infection. There are many reports of severe long-term diseases of the past, including the recurrent gastric distress and exhaustion that severely limited Charles Darwin's work schedule for most of his life, that we may never be able to identify. In Darwin's case, historians and physicians have proposed a brain disease from a South American insect bite, the effects of long-term self-medication with a patent medicine, the stress of controversy and family tragedies, and most recently, chronic fatigue syndrome. Thus, we probably will never be able to say how much more chronic illness exists now than did 100 or 150 years ago. But no matter how much of the shift to chronic illness is organic and how much is cultural or psychological, chronic illness is what we fear most. Whether new or just newly identified, chronic illnesses run counter to most of the strengths of technological medicine. Physicians do not want only to care, they want to cure. The director of a major New York hospital once acknowledged that in a setting for acute medical treatment, chronic disease is an accusation, and a desire to do more for chronic patients conflicts with frustration in treating acute disease. Staff members are demoralized when nothing can be done. The medical sociologist Anselm L. Strauss and his colleagues have listed 7 characteristics that set chronic illnesses apart. They are long-term by nature. Workers have to be prepared to help patients for years rather than days or weeks. They have an uncertain prognosis, with acute episodes alternating with periods of remission, while new treatments are always under evaluation. They demand relatively more symptomatic relief, which in turn can be costly. They are multiple diseases, in which the breakdown of one system can damage others, a characteristic of tight coupling, as Perot has pointed out. They are socially disruptive for patients, who may not be able to keep their jobs or living arrangements. They need a variety of social as well as medical services. And they are costly. There is yet another characteristic, especially for chronically ill people without major disabilities. They encourage unorthodox treatments. Physicians are beginning to realize that a large number of their patients, fully a third according to one survey, are seeing chiropractors, acupuncturists, massage and relaxation therapists, and other unconventional practitioners, usually to supplement standard medical care. Overwhelmingly, these providers treat chronic complaints, including back pain, allergies, arthritis, headaches, and sleep disorders. The same American public, otherwise internationally known for its love of intensive medical intervention, is equally ready to look elsewhere when medical science and technology don't appear to work. Management of some chronic illnesses has improved enormously in the 20th century. Diabetes is one. As early as 1923, the isolation of insulin made it possible to control a condition affecting millions. The Diabetes Control and Complications Trial, a 10-year American study begun in 1983, showed that tighter control of insulin dosage could reduce eye, kidney, and nerve complications dramatically. But technology once more has brought not a tidy solution, but a burden of additional vigilance. Insulin therapy demands constant attention to maintaining proper dosage of the hormone in order to avoid circulation problems that can lead to blindness and amputations. To be certain that blood sugar does not exceed or drop below a narrow range, patients need to test their blood up to 12 times daily and inject repeated doses of insulin. This intensive self-monitoring requires hours of training, strict self-discipline, and medical supervision. Continuous insulin pumps can simplify injection, but need watching too. So in mainstream as well as alternative medicine, chronic disease reinforces the necessity of constant care, belying hopes that technology can release us from attention to open-ended, repetitive work. The cost of survival. Since it is so hard to say how new or even how changed a disease is, a better way to approach technology and the history of chronic illness is to see how improvements in care can actually help increase the number of people left with chronic conditions. Survival is, of course, nearly always better than the alternative, and the contributions that people with chronic conditions and disabilities make are immense. Calling the problems of survival revenge effects, then, does not imply that saving people is futile. It does mean that in solving one problem, reducing the casualties of catastrophes, we have created another that also demands better solutions. Late 20th century technology has given survivors of catastrophic injury an unprecedented chance to continue developing and using their abilities. Computers and peripherals can scan and read text, recognize spoken commands, and even synthesize speech. New materials help restore motor function and mobility. Unfortunately, technology is able to do much less about the chronic mental disturbances that can follow psychological trauma. The cultural historian Wolfgang Schivelbusch has shown how important railroad accidents became in creating and bringing to notice the chronic mental disturbance that the late 20th century was to call post-traumatic stress disorder. Schivelbusch quotes an 1866 treatise by the medical writer William Camps. Camps believed that the severity of railroad accidents was assaulting the nervous system in an unprecedented way. Even where physical injuries were slight, there could be, quote, such a shock to the system as for a time to shatter the whole constitution, and this, moreover, to such a degree, to such an extent, that the unfortunate sufferer may not altogether recover throughout the remainder of his life, which may be curtailed in its duration, unquote. Another early author, John Eric Erickson, writing independently, described the sufferings of an accident survivor, deficiencies in memory, sexual function and digestion, tiredness, insomnia, and nightmares. Improvements in control, signaling, tracks, rolling stock, and brakes could reduce the rate of physical accidents. Better emergency treatment could save even more survivors, and it is possible that as men and women became accustomed to motion at higher speeds, the perceived shock of accidents diminished, at least in the absence of serious physical injury. But the chronic psychological outcome of catastrophes has continued to trouble medical and legal writers. Like other forms of pain and suffering, it presents the problem, uncomfortable to quantitative investigators, of being both real and unmeasurable. And it poses the dilemma, disturbing to legal analysts, of ignoring suffering or rewarding fraud. It was not in civilian accidents, though, that the most striking chronic consequences of the catastrophic appeared. The very efficiency of military medicine that, as we have seen, sent more and more wounded troops back to the battlefield also contributed to the changed nature of wartime casualties. Post-traumatic stress grew daily in medical and social importance in war after war. The Vietnam conflict, ironically, seemed to show that the psychological toll of warfare could be slashed. Like the mortality rate in military hospitals, the curve of battle-related mental illness appeared to be turning downward. In the First World War, an estimated 200,000 British soldiers were discharged for shell shock, despite early official prohibition of the diagnosis and often brutal treatment of those affected. In the Second World War, what we now call post-traumatic stress accounted for 23% of casualties. In the Korean War, this was cut to 12%, and in Vietnam, it was only one-tenth the Korean rate, or 1.2%. And a psychiatrist believed that only 5% of these were true combat fatigue. 40% were problems that could have begun after discharge from service. The Army believed it had learned from previous wars. It set limits to tours of duty. It returned wounded soldiers quickly to combat. Yet as the years went by after the Vietnam War ended, it became apparent how serious and difficult to treat were the war's psychological consequences. The most comprehensive recent study by William Schlenger of the Research Triangle Institute estimates that a third of all Vietnam combat veterans, a total of about 470,000, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Symptoms often did not appear until a year or more after discharge. As the psychologist Ghislain Boulanger has pointed out, PTSD was a new diagnosis, but the same syndrome as the war neuroses of earlier conflicts. Like them, it was directly related to the intensity of combat experience. Studies from the Second World War also showed that symptoms could last for decades. As in earlier war neuroses, symptoms included vivid re-experience of traumatic wartime events, usually in sleep, but sometimes while awake. Boulanger, following the third edition of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM-3, also lists excessive autonomic arousal, hyper-alertness, exaggerated startle reactions, difficulty falling asleep, and the feeling of being on the edge of losing control. It was the time lag between the traumatic event and the appearance of symptoms that delayed official recognition of the syndrome by American psychiatry. Despite decades of research on post-traumatic stress, not only among troops but among survivors of incest, rape, and other crimes, we still understand little about the circumstances in which the event produces the symptom. We cannot link the relatively long onset time and longer persistence of PTSD among Vietnam veterans to any single feature of the conflict. Nor can we say that the success of evacuation and treatment directly contributed to PTSD. Yet, indirectly, it probably did. The Vietnam combat experience was even more stressful than the conventional battlefields of previous wars. The excellence of medical treatment not only increased the effectiveness of American forces, but may have encouraged commanders to expose more troops to the frontline conditions that eventually led to PTSD, just as some users of civilian safety equipment take risks they otherwise would shun. The military medicine that had succeeded so brilliantly in dealing with the catastrophes of combat proved unable to anticipate or prevent its long-term chronic consequences. The long-term consequences of better emergency medicine can be agonizing in civilian life, too. Organic brain injury has assumed tragic proportions over the last 20 years. In the 1970s, the United States government began a far-reaching technological assault on the hundreds of thousands of annual deaths from trauma. It helped improve telephone response, rescue services, and hospital emergency rooms, often with skills developed during the Vietnam era. New imaging and brain surgery techniques spread. While shock trauma centers have been able to save 2 out of 3 serious head injury cases and to monitor the swelling of the brain that is responsible for massive damage, the net result of better medical treatment for emergency cases is the survival of unprecedented numbers of head-injured patients. Even with the best care, the brain needs more prompt attention than other injured organs. For the rest of the body, the grace period may be an hour or more. For the higher functions of the brain, it may be minutes. Head injuries still account for millions of emergency room visits and for 500,000 hospitalizations each year in the United States. Trauma to the head is still the largest single cause of death for Americans under 24. But between the late 1970s and the late 1980s, according to the National Head Injury Foundation, the survival rate increased from 5% to 50 or 60%, an improvement that led to a silent epidemic of disability. The number of teenage head injury survivors alone has quadrupled. Of brain trauma survivors, up to 90,000 a year have severe disabilities. For reading, for speaking, for mobility, there are hundreds of devices that have helped people with physical limitations. But for many forms of brain damage, there still are few products that restore independence. Hundreds of thousands of brain-injured people need both high and low technology care, both labor-intensive. Home care can become a full-time task. Normal swallowing and breathing may be impossible. Incontinence can prevent normal participation in society. Even when the injury does not fully disable a survivor, it can change personality in dramatic ways. A brain-damaged person may not recognize the parents or children who are providing care. The injury may have so impaired memory that the person will never reestablish relationships, will ask the same questions day after day. In a famous paper, The Head Injured Family, the neuropsychologist D. Neil Brooks has reviewed the disturbing conclusions of research on the lives of spouses, children, and others close to brain injury survivors. Brain damage disrupts domestic and social life even more profoundly than spinal cord injuries do. The burden often grows heavier with time, not lighter as with many other disabilities. Depression and anxiety are common. Up to 9 in 10 feel trapped. The very efficacy of our response to sudden injuries has left us with an epidemic of prolonged suffering, not just of individuals, but of whole families. Surviving childhood illness. Even medicine's greatest success stories in treating chronic illness have multiplied other chronic conditions. Survivors of acute conditions have long been familiar with chronic consequences. Post-polio muscular atrophy may eventually affect as many as a quarter of the 250,000 to 300,000 survivors of the American polio epidemic of the 1950s. It mimics the effects of aging and arthritis. Nerves signaling muscles, including muscles not apparently affected by the original disease, are destroyed. Though records go back more than a century, doctors were slow to acknowledge the reality of post-polio syndrome. Even in the early 1990s, it was not clear whether muscle strength actually declines more in post-polio patients than in healthy people of the same age. The recent improvement of the rate of survival from childhood cancer is in some ways as impressive a story as the development of the vaccines that virtually eliminated poliomyelitis. 7 out of 10 pediatric cancer patients live 5 years. Only 2 of 10 adult patients do. One estimate predicts over 200,000 American survivors of childhood cancer by the year 2000, or one adult in 900. Yet in one study of childhood survivors, 4 out of 10 identified physical or mental problems brought on by treatment. Successful therapies can still cause reproductive difficulties, cataracts, and heart disease. Radiation can damage bones and lung tissues, and its application in cases of brain tumors often turns out to impair learning ability and may even cause some mental retardation. For these children, there is a tenfold increase in the probability of a future cancer, and most of that increase is due to therapy rather than to any genetic tendency. The revenge effects of survival may go beyond the effects of trauma and childhood disease. There is the less clearly documented but real possibility that the decline of infectious disease, both from medical intervention and from better education and living conditions, has actually promoted chronic illness. This is the thesis of the historian James C. Riley, who has adopted the concept of insult accumulation from an essay by the medical physicist Hardin B. Jones. Jones argued, in effect, that any sickness is hazardous to your long-term health. In Riley's quotation and paraphrase, quote, "Every disease episode does some damage to physiologic function. Diseases tend to facilitate the growth of disease states at all ages, including adulthood. Favored cohorts, those that have experienced less disease, enjoy longer lifespans and greater vigor at every subsequent stage of life," unquote. As expanded by other medical theorists and by Riley, insult accumulation means that diseases, injuries, and risk factors, like cigarettes and alcohol, don't cause only overt and recognized damage. While infections may produce a beneficial and adaptive immune response, insult accumulation theorists believe that lasting tissue damage may make the body less resistant to future stress by shifting resources to repair and adaptation. Riley's hypothesis is difficult to test, but evolutionary theory argues for it. The most important single study was a review of 3,000 autopsies performed by a San Francisco physician, William O'Fules, in the first quarter of this century. O'Fules' most important finding was that people with a history of infectious disease showed significantly more arterial and heart disease. Other conditions, he believed, hastened heart disease by damaging arterial walls. Lesions arising during an early disease episode could attract plaque and so lead to arteriosclerosis. Riley analyzed the records of the sick funds of late 19th century England. He concluded that while more workers survived into their 40s and 50s as time went on, in any given age range there was a higher rate of illness. People were living longer, but appeared to be sicker as they got older, at least until they reached 65, when aging itself became a more important source of impairment than previous disease. Insult accumulation is the strongest general form of a revenge theory of medicine. It is also the most speculative because its factual base is so weak. As the case for silicosis shows, it is not easy to study slow-onset conditions even with modern imaging techniques. Even if insult accumulation is a valid hypothesis, avoiding injury and illness at all costs would almost certainly have revenge effects of its own. It would imply a highly protected and isolated childhood, one without the chance to acquire the antibodies so useful to the mature adult. As early as the 1920s and 1930s, epidemiologists were finding that the crusade for cleanliness at the beginning of the century, far from combating polio, was promoting it. When all infants acquired the virus in the first days of their lives, while still protected by antibodies from their mother's blood, paralysis was almost unknown. Epidemics became most severe where standards of plumbing and cleanliness were highest. There, young people were first exposed to the virus long after the end of maternal immunity. German measles, too, turned into a serious adult disease only after fewer and fewer children were infected with it. Most recently, the science writer Lynn Payer has pointed out that the more casual French attitude toward exposure to germs makes their effects less severe in later life. In countries where fewer people have had hepatitis A and toxoplasmosis in childhood, more people are seriously affected when they have the disease for the first time at a later age. We will not be able to judge the insult accumulation hypothesis or to draw conclusions for living habits and medical practice until the science of long-term health reaches maturity. Are we booby-trapped? Evolutionary theory suggests that we don't need the concept of insult accumulation to explain the increase of chronic and degenerative illness. Plants and animals in nature succumb to all kinds of natural hazards, accidents, and predators while in perfect health. Even without any disease, populations of a given age would thin out naturally as time went on, a fact stressed by the evolutionary biologist George C. Williams. Natural selection favors organisms that reproduce rapidly and early. Think of a gene that helps an animal multiply relatively early in life, but increases its risk of cancer, say, years later. Those eventual deaths will retard the spread of the gene, it is true. But quite independently of the gene, few animals carrying it may survive to an age when it would promote the disease. The early gain would outweigh the later loss. Natural selection neglects the fitness of organisms that have passed their peak reproductive years. As the evolutionary biologist Stephen Austad has put it, quote, "Since most new mutations are harmful, and since mutations with effects late in life tend not to be weeded out, late-acting harmful mutations can accumulate over time," unquote. In fact, we know of mechanisms that help early reproductive success at the cost of an individual's long-term health. The biologists Robert M. Sapolsky and Caleb E. Finch have pointed out that the mating season of Pacific salmon and marsupial mice exposes these animals to extraordinary levels of glucocorticoids, a hormonal death switch, as they call it. Yet this stress is a byproduct of the intense reproductive activity that helps maintain these species. Some human genes may promote reproduction at an early age at the cost of later chronic illness. Sapolsky and Finch point to the higher-than-normal sexual activity and reproduction rate of men with the Huntington's disease gene. They cite research suggesting that prostate cancer is also a consequence of genes that promote seminal fluid production and thus greater fertility earlier in life. It is likely that more studies will show how the very genes that help our species reproduce in early life turn against it later. Even without insult accumulation, simply surviving accidents, injuries, and food shortages with improved technology gives us that much more time for the latent lethal genes to act, yet another way of running from catastrophic hazards to chronic risks. Resurging infection. So far, we have seen the rise of chronic illness helped by the success of technology in preventing and repairing the results of injury and infectious disease. but there is also a sense in which control of infectious disease, while still effective, has turned out to be a chronic problem in itself, long rather than short-term, demanding vigilance, increasingly costly, and without a neat solution in sight. Where we once hoped to eradicate, we are now struggling to manage. Intensive use of drugs against some bacteria and viruses has helped promote the growth of resistant strains. At the same time, medical pessimists have turned out to be as wrong as the optimists. Even the greatest medical disaster of recent origin, HIV infection, is not the kind of plague that it was at first feared to be. Medication has helped transform it, in many cases, into a slower and longer-term condition that has more in common with cancer and other dreaded chronic illnesses than with the acute epidemics that once decimated Europe overnight. Only a generation ago, we seemed to be on the verge of the chemical conquest of infection. In 1967, U.S. Surgeon General William H. Stuart declared it was time to close the books on infectious disease. 25 years later, the books are open again. People are beginning to fear infection once more. The streptococcal attack that killed the puppeteer Jim Henson in 1990 was one of tens of thousands of adult cases in the United States in the early 1990s. As far as we know, this resurgence had nothing to do with the antibiotics that had helped make the most feared complication of streptococcal infection, rheumatic fever, a rarity among children. In fact, specialists believe that prompt antibiotic treatment could have saved Henson's life. But resistance has become a serious problem in treating other infections. The natural selection of drug-resistant strains has been known since the early days of antibiotics. Penicillin-resistant bacteria were at first only a minor problem. Alexander Fleming discovered that use of penicillin would select mutant strains with walls resistant to the drug. He warned as early as 1945 that, freely taken, an oral form of the drug could breed resistant strains that could then infect other people, especially if patients stopped treatment before all bacteria were destroyed. Resistance turned out to be more serious than Fleming had expected. Treatment indeed selected for natural variants of bacteria that could not only resist, but destroy penicillin. Resistant strains began to overwhelm hospitals in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Then, in the 1970s, resistant forms of the bacteria causing meningitis and gonorrhea began to appear. When streptomycin was introduced against the tuberculosis bacillus, a dangerously rapid rate of mutation led scientists to develop a family of related antibiotics in the 1950s and 1960s, some of which are still widely used. Tetracyclines and other broad-spectrum antibiotics were also introduced beginning in the late 1940s. In this case, the alarming rise of resistance had one positive effect, promoting research into bacterial structure. Bacterial plasmids, minute self-replicating pieces of DNA outside the chromosome, add valuable capabilities to their hosts. Plasmids conferring antibiotic resistance to their host bacteria naturally multiplied vigorously in the presence of penicillin and other antibiotics. Most seriously, in 1959, a bacterium appeared in Japan that resisted 4 antibiotics, and the same resistance was soon found in another bacterium. Plasmids, called R factors, were moving among bacterial species. R factors have always been present. So have plasmids. Introduction of antibiotics created a powerful evolutionary pressure. The mechanisms of genetic exchange among bacteria, their plasmids, and associated viruses, phages, allow an unceasing transfer of resistance genes. Otherwise harmless bacteria in the human urogenital and respiratory tracts now carry resistance genes that they furnish to pathogenic bacteria. While there are also genes that express specific mechanisms for neutralizing the effects of particular antibiotics or for destroying them, microbiologists have found that resistance accumulates. Bacteria assemble their own arsenals of resistant genes as hackers swap access codes and passwords. We are awakening from the 19th century dream of specificity. The boundaries between species and organisms are not as well defined as our ancestors believed. In only 50 years, we have gone from the offense to the defense. And that should not be completely surprising, since the 2 human generations since the introduction of antibiotics have faced countless bacterial generations. In hindsight, antibiotics and the smaller number of antiviral drugs are what lawyers call wasting assets. We deplete their value slightly each time we use them. Always present as natural substances in the soil and in some traditional remedies, they had never been released massively until the Second World War and its aftermath. Even conservative use would have promoted resistance genes, though, of course, more slowly. Because the world has become a single microbiological system, drugs can stay effective only if used conservatively, not only where they were introduced, but wherever they are available. The actions of every physician and every patient help determine the length of a medication's useful life. Alternatives usually cost much more than the drugs for which they have been substituted. The startling wartime successes of penicillin created the dangerous myth of an antibiotic panacea. Even after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration began to require prescriptions in the mid-1950s, an antibiotic injection or prescription remained for many people the payoff of a medical encounter. They resisted the medical fact that antibiotics can do nothing against colds and other viral diseases. In many other countries, antibiotics are still sold legally over the counter to patients who may never get proper instructions about dosage or the importance of completing a course of treatment. Dr. Stuart B. Levy of Boston cites an Argentinian businessman who was cured of leukemia but died of an infection by the common bacterium E. coli. 10 years of self-medication had produced plasmids in his body that were resistant to every antibiotic used. Governments, too, have unintentionally promoted resurgence. Indonesian authorities have literally ladled out preventive doses of tetracycline to 100,000 Muslim pilgrims for a week at a time. Since the Mecca pilgrimage has historically been one of the great mixing bowls of microorganisms, it is especially disturbing to learn that half of all cholera bacilli in Africa are now resistant to tetracycline. Until recently, bacterial resistance was good for the drug business. Older medications lose protection against generic versions. Resistant strains create opportunities for patenting new drugs. But the industry is discovering that new products, too, can have disappointingly short useful lives. Promotion of one new antibiotic, ciprofloxacin, destroyed much of its greatest asset, inexpensive protection against hospital-based infections, within a few years of its U.S. introduction. One critic of industry promotion, Dr. Calvin Cunin, has compared resistance to the planned obsolescence of automobiles, but others fear that pharmaceutical companies have lost interest in developing new antibiotics even as the old ones lose their power. The U.S. National Institutes of Health, concentrating funds on AIDS, also have cut back. Only 5 new antimicrobials were approved in 1991 and only 2 in 1990. Steady application of antibiotics on the farm has also been crowding the commons. Most U.S. swine, poultry, cattle, and even farmed fish get regular doses of antibiotics. In the 1980s, the proportion of drug-resistant salmonella bacteria doubled from 16% to 32%. Animals and people have been exchanging antibiotic-resistance genes, and people who are taking antibiotics become more vulnerable to salmonella bacteria because antibiotics have wiped out so many beneficial or neutral intestinal bacteria. Like a disturbed grassland, the body on antibiotics is primed for an invasion of weed species. Mitchell L. Cohen of the National Center for Infectious Diseases has warned that without prompt action, the post-antimicrobial era may be rapidly approaching in which infectious disease wards housing untreatable conditions again will be seen. The return of tuberculosis in New York City in the 1990s shows how fragile our line of antibiotic defense can be. In the 1970s, TB hospitals seemed costly relics in an age of miracle cures. New York, New Jersey, and other states abolished their inpatient treatment centers, relying on outpatient treatment. When declining living standards, intravenous drug use, and AIDS began to help spread TB again, a revenge effect of drug therapy appeared. Like some other antibiotics, TB drugs need to be taken for a time after the symptoms of the disease are no longer apparent to the patient. A full course of treatment takes from 6 months to 2 years. Even infected, but not diseased, health professionals in at least one study failed to complete their course of treatment, another measure of what a burden vigilance can be. An interrupted course does not in itself promote resistant strains of the TB bacterium, but if the initial prescription is not appropriate, and if patients discontinue some pills before others, bacteria will be selected for multi-drug resistance. Pieces of DNA, called transposons, hop easily from cell to cell, transferring resistance genes, which accumulate. Expert treatment can reduce the chance of developing multiple resistance, but it demands a carefully balanced combination of antibiotics taken together. The chief tuberculosis control official for the New York City Department of Health, Tom Frieden, has acknowledged that only a couple of dozen doctors in the city are capable of managing tuberculosis cases properly. In the early 1990s, about 1 in 7 new tuberculosis infections resisted one or more drugs. In New York City, half of all cases have resisted treatment. For patients infected with bacilli resistant to the two leading antibiotics, isoniazid and rifampin, cure rates may be only 56% or less. Antibiotic resistance does not have to return us to pre-penicillin days, but it shows how a technology that seems decisive can turn into a protracted effort. Antibiotics once appeared to mark a decisive change in the human relationship to bacterial infections, just as vaccination effectively removed smallpox from the list of dread diseases. What they actually accomplished was still considerable, but different. Antibiotics took a problem of acute illness and turned it into one of chronic attention. It is not a solvable problem, but it can be a manageable one if antibiotic resistance can be protected as a resource. In Tanzania, for example, authorities have limited the spread of drug-resistant strains of TB. In the long run, as we will see later, there are better ways to protect ourselves from microorganisms, to domesticate them. Antibiotic-resistant TB is not only a menace in its own right, but a powerful ally of an even greater threat, the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. Given the chance, this virus and TB bacteria can activate each other in a deadly synergy. Even more than the revival of tuberculosis, the emergence of new viruses like HIV has shaken the medical optimism that prevailed from the early antibiotic era through the 1970s. Acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, AIDS, has shown how a virus previously undetected in human beings can, in less than a generation, become one of the world's most serious public health problems. A few researchers claim that AIDS itself is a revenge effect of African field tests for a polio vaccine, but this theory has been found to have too many missing links. How HIV became a virulent source of human disease is still unknown, nor do we yet understand how diet, sexual habits, and living conditions affect the immune system's ability to neutralize HIV toxins and delay the onset of full-blown AIDS. The population biologists Roy M. Anderson and Robert M. May have concluded from molecular sequencing studies that human HIV may have been present in Africa for more than a century, possibly for more than two. Some researchers now think it could have been a human virus before it became a monkey virus. Just as virulent strains of the ubiquitous and normally harmless bacterium E. coli occasionally appear, the HIV virus may have coexisted harmlessly with human beings for a century or more. The answer will be hard to find, because infectious diseases with a doubling time of a few years can spread very slowly for decades and then extend explosively, leaving few traces of their history. In Africa, shifting populations, rural poverty, separation of male workers from families, and the growth of road networks in the 20th century created ideal conditions for disseminating the virus. But it may also have been present in North America and Europe long before its supposed invasion from Africa. Whatever the mechanisms and geography of AIDS, it and other emerging viruses could well be a revenge effect of our victories against other infectious diseases. The physician and historian Mirko D. Grimek has proposed the concept of pathocenosis. Disease organisms, he has suggested, don't exist independently of each other in human populations. Instead, different microorganisms form a complex equilibrium. Grimek believes that pathocenoses have gone through four upheavals: the Neolithic shift to agriculture, the medieval migrations of peoples of the Asian steppes, the biological exchanges following the discovery of the New World, and the present combination of declining infectious disease and accelerating worldwide exchange of pathogens. Virulent strains of AIDS probably were at a competitive disadvantage in populations widely infected with diseases like tuberculosis and malaria, even though TB can spread more rapidly in populations already infected with the AIDS virus. The retreat of TB in Europe and the United States and of malaria in Africa may have changed the balance of pathogens to the advantage of virulent HIV. Gromek's hypothesis is still difficult to prove or disprove, but if it is correct, malaria, tuberculosis, and other infectious diseases actually helped keep virulent HIV in check. When medical researchers tardily recognized the existence of AIDS as a syndrome, it appeared at first that in the industrial countries too, it was destined to become a catastrophic epidemic comparable to the bubonic plague, cholera, and typhoid. Its concentration in certain stigmatized groups, gay and bisexual men, intravenous drug users, and their partners, increased the sense of dread. Proposals circulated for quarantines and even compulsory tattooing of HIV-positive people. By the mid-1980s, Americans feared millions of deaths. In Africa and Asia, the spread of HIV is indeed confirming the worst fears of early estimates. The World Health Organization, WHO, has calculated an increase of adult HIV in Africa south of the Sahara from 2.5 million cases to 6.5 million between 1987 and 1992, with fully 18 million infections projected by the turn of the century. The WHO already recognizes a million cases in South and Southeast Asia. In the United States, AIDS claimed 166,467 lives between 1982 and 1992. 45,472 new cases were reported in 1992. Less than 5 years after the most catastrophic predictions, AIDS began to appear in a new light, no less alarming, but different. Daniel M. Fox and Elizabeth Fee began to point out in the late 1980s that as AIDS chemotherapy improved, as research burgeoned, and as hospitals established programs for long-term care, AIDS was behaving less like a plague and more like cancer. Changes in behavior following public education campaigns may have also played a part. By June 1989, the director of the U.S. National Cancer Institute, speaking at the International AIDS Conference, was explicitly calling AIDS a chronic illness, one directly comparable to cancer. The analogy proved all too apt. As in the cancer crusade that began in the 1960s, early hope yielded to pessimism. The chairman and chief executive of Merck declared in 1988 that the company expected to find an anti-AIDS drug within 5 years. By 1992, he acknowledged to the Wall Street Journal his enormous disappointment. The rapid mutations of HIV, as of other viruses, appear to make eradication almost impossible. The drug most widely used to arrest and reverse the multiplication of the AIDS virus, AZT, received approval in 1987. It has been thought to delay the onset of AIDS symptoms, though this effect is now disputed, and to retard the action of the virus in people with AIDS. But it is, at best, no cure, and it has severe side effects. For those very reasons, it resembles many cancer treatments. As with cancer, hospital-based medicine can deal with acute episodes without halting the progression of the disease. But AIDS is also like other infectious diseases. AZT-resistant strains of the virus are a growing problem. AZT may have a social revenge effect. By prolonging life, as Anderson and May have pointed out, it may help spread the virus in the community if it does not reduce the infectiousness of the virus and if people being treated don't take precautions to avoid transmission. All in all, then, technology can hold back the spread of the AIDS virus, but not yet technology in the form of antiviral drugs or vaccines. It is rather the technology of vigilance upon which we must rely for now. Autoclaves, disposable syringes, condoms, rubber gloves, and other safeguards. The price of living. So far, we have seen revenge effects linked to efforts against acute and infectious illnesses, but can efforts against chronic illness have revenge effects of their own? Here there seems less room for technology. To the contrary, physicians and epidemiologists urge healthier living. Quit smoking, reduce intake of saturated fat and cholesterol, eat more fresh fruits and vegetables, exercise regularly, sleep adequately, and so forth. Changed habits have helped cut the incidence of heart disease significantly over the last generation. Once more, what matters is the cumulative effect of small acts of vigilance rather than some new technology. But attempts to avoid chronic illness are not all free of risk. Using technology as a shield against environmental danger can actually increase exposure by multiplying the hazard, a repeating effect. A cigarette, for example, is a drug delivery system for nicotine. Cigarette smokers depend so much on a steady level of nicotine that when they try filtered low-tar and nicotine brands, most unconsciously compensate for the reduced volume of nicotine by inhaling more often or more deeply, and even by blocking the tiny ventilation holes in filters that are supposed to dilute their intake with air. Some even break off filters, thinking the tobacco itself is safer. The tobacco in these cigarettes has the same nicotine and tar content as that in other brands. While brands with low tar and nicotine are in themselves a slightly smaller health risk than standard smokes, manufacturers market them as alternatives to quitting. An editorial in the American Journal of Public Health speculates, quote, that the existence of low tar nicotine cigarettes has actually caused more smoking than would have occurred in their absence, and thereby raise the morbidity and mortality associated with smoking, unquote. And it continues that technological solutions to smoking's health hazards, quote, precisely fit the thinking emblematic of an addicted individual. The user tries to solve a problem in a manner that lets drug consumption continue without interruption, unquote. Just one alternative delivery system, the nicotine patch, offers a way to reduce intake gradually and generally only if used as part of carefully supervised therapy. Filter materials also need evaluation. The vaunted micronite filter of Kent cigarettes in the mid-1950s contained crocidolite asbestos that may have compounded cancer deaths in smokers even after the formula was discontinued later in the decade. Sunscreens protect conditionally at best against carcinogenic ultraviolet light. The most common types of the 1990s stop one form of solar radiation, ultraviolet B, or UVB, responsible for burning the outer layer of skin. But the absence of visible tanning conceals the penetration of lower levels of the skin by another form, ultraviolet A, UVA. If a sun-blocking product encourages people to feel safer while sunbathing without a visible tan, and if it does not block UVA effectively, it could be an encouragement to get more UVA exposure. The epidemiologists, Frank and Cedric Garland, have reported evidence that sunscreens may contribute indirectly to the increase of melanoma, a form of cancer deadlier than the squamous cell cancers of the epidermis. They also believe sunscreens may interfere with the skin's natural synthesis of vitamin D. The Garlands acknowledge that statistics linking sunscreen use with melanoma are hard to assess, since those with the greatest UV exposure are also heavy sunscreen users. Most other epidemiologists and dermatologists do not accept the Garland's conclusions, but sunscreen manufacturers are careful not to claim cancer prevention. Dieting. Even more widely used than cigarette filters and sunscreens, and equally subject to revenge effects, are the technologies of weight control. Since smoking does regulate eating to some extent, the decline of tobacco has helped shift attention to diets and nutrition. Dieting was uncommon in the 1950s and 1960s, when surveys showed that only one person in 10 was trying to lose weight. By 1985, 55% of women and 41% of men responding to a Psychology Today survey reported dissatisfaction with their weight. In 1989, about a quarter of all men and 40% of women were reducing. Medical guidelines of the time suggested that 39% of men and 36% of women weighed too much for their height. Fashion played a part, too. Top models and actresses are much thinner than average people and than their predecessors were in the 1960s. One estimate is that their body fat is slightly more than half the 22 to 26% of healthy women of normal weight. Diet organizations, books, and foods are a $30 billion a year industry. The health-conscious decade of the 1970s, with its ethic of personal responsibility for health, probably made the difference. Even critics of dieting and of excessive health consciousness agree that many gains were real. Consciousness of exercise and nutrition and lower rates of smoking and drinking helped reduce deaths from heart disease by 40% and of stroke by more than 50% between 1970 and 1990. Yet the link between overweight and cardiovascular diseases, hypertension, diabetes, and other diseases may not be as strong as some influential insurance industry studies once suggested. As the effects of smoking, hypertension, and elevated cholesterol are accounted for, fat people are not necessarily sicker than normal weight or thin people. As long as overweight and normal weight men and women consider fatness unhealthy, the sense of responsibility can have alarming consequences. The psychologist Kelly D. Brownell has pointed out that it can lead people to think they have more control than they do. Fat people face discrimination in jobs and services, and even unprovoked insults from strangers. The poor are more likely to be fat not only because they eat more fats and starches, but also because fat people are more likely to be poor. So oppressive is the stigma of self-indulgence and gluttony that of one group of patients who had surgery for weight reduction, all would rather have diabetes or heart disease than be fat again. 9 out of 10 would rather be blind. Unfortunately for those who need or want to lose weight, the human body has plans of its own. We still understand very imperfectly how the body's weight is regulated. The hypothalamus now seems to be only one of several regions of the brain that control long- and short-term mechanisms. As physiologists and nutritionists point out, it is amazing that human weight fluctuates so little. Even a tiny long-term imbalance of diet, as little as 0.03% of food consumed, appears to account for adult weight gain between youth and old age. Unfortunately for dieters, the body has evolved to cope far better with famine and shortage than with abundance. According to one widely held theory, it seeks an equilibrium or set point weight that varies with each person's physiology. The body interprets any significant loss of weight as deprivation and compensates by slowing its metabolism. The dieter, compelled to consume fewer and fewer calories to lose each additional pound, understandably becomes depressed and preoccupied with food and eating. It becomes ever more likely that the dieter will break the regimen. Then the body, true to its evolutionary heritage, tries to regain weight as fast as possible. The psychologist C. Peter Herman believes the dieter pays interest on the debt of lost weight, gaining somewhat more after the diet because of defensive adjustments that protect the body against future dieting attempts by raising the regulated level of body weight slash fat. As the old ad had it, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. Compounding the body's own readjustments, lapsed dieters are often prodigious binge eaters. The increasing self-denial of a diet makes weight loss appear an all-or-nothing proposition. In one study, subjects were told that they were evaluating food tastes and then given 10 minutes to judge ice cream. Some of them were also given milkshakes to evaluate before they were offered the ice cream. Non-dieters who had drunk milkshakes ate less ice cream than those who had not, but the reverse was true of dieters. Dieters given milkshakes actually ate even more than a control group of dieters who had not eaten beforehand. Dieters, Herman and his colleague Janet Polivy believe, treat a single lapse as a release from their daily quota. Fear of breaking the diet paradoxically creates a sense of failure that becomes an excuse for binging. And dieting, by making control of food intake a more conscious, deliberate act, seems to impair satiety. Dieters are slower to receive that enough already message that protects most other people against binging. In a survey of the Harvard class of 1982, alumni who had dieted during college were more likely than others to have gained 10 pounds or more. The set point of human weight may not be fixed as firmly as skeptics about dieting once thought. It appears possible to lose moderate amounts of weight slowly without the hunger that triggers the revenge effects that come from limiting calories. The nutritional psychologist David Levitsky and his colleagues, in a rare long-term controlled study of human eating patterns, discovered that women eating exclusively low-fat foods could lose weight steadily and persistently without consciously limiting calories, about half a pound a week, or 10% of body weight a year. This regimen allows low-fat desserts. It probably works mainly by substituting lower-calorie carbohydrate and protein for higher-calorie fat. People disciplined about avoiding fat can reduce their weight slowly and safely. Still, the technology of low-fat food can have revenge effects of its own. As the food writer Trish Hall pointed out, a piece of non-fat cake weighing as much as an average 65-calorie apple may have 560 calories. Especially outside a laboratory setting, repeating effects can cancel the benefits of low-fat eating. The obese have to take another approach. For them, weight control does not seem to be a one-time event, but a continuing process. The alternatives are unpleasant. Continued obesity, with great social disadvantages and possible medical problems. Constant and painful hunger, or lifetime medication. Physicians and patients are redefining obesity as a chronic disease like diabetes or hypertension, to be managed rather than as a problem to be solved. The price of this last definition is a lifetime of dependence on prescription drugs. Once more, technology does not so much solve a problem as create a new need for vigilance and repetitive actions. Health crisis and medical outlook. The same technology that was so effective in treating traumatic and acute infection also promoted chronic disability and pain. There are signs that as early as 100 years ago, longer illnesses were a side effect of longer life. Pneumonia, bacterial infections, and other acute complications are now less likely to end the lives of chronically ill patients. Rapid evacuation, prompt treatment, and improved techniques have multiplied the survival rate of the military wounded and of civilian accident victims alike. We are living longer, but thanks in part to technological advances, we are also more likely to suffer from conditions that medicine can only manage, not cure. Even our control of acute illness has turned out to be much more tenuous than we had imagined. We have made infectious agents into moving targets. The antibiotic triumphs of the 1940s and 1950s were not victories, but only a respite. The generations that followed exploited and began to exhaust what turned out to be a finite reservoir of effectiveness. Antibiotic resistance is itself a chronic condition, a response so flexible that our best hope appears to be not to defeat it, but only to manage and delay it with a combination of medical conservatism, limits on agricultural use, multiple drug strategies, new vaccines, and the unceasing deployment of new agents. Most ominously, the ravages of AIDS have shown how expanding continental and world transportation and 20th-century technologies of intravenous drug administration and of blood transfusion can disperse fatal viruses as well as bacteria on a global scale. With other emerging viral and bacterial diseases, it has eroded the old colonial-era distinction between endemic tropical diseases and Western epidemics. AIDS and other rapidly mutating viral diseases have also shown the limits of the 19th-century goal of targeting specific causes. In extending the lives of people with HIV, AZT and other therapies are slowing the progression of AIDS without halting it, adding it to the managed chronic illnesses. Environmental disruption and mass migration have led to fatal pandemics so often that it is hard to be optimistic about the short run. But there is also a positive paradox of research. The 19th century's own sense of crisis made possible the public health measures that succeeded in sharply reducing the impact of infection. Industrial nations are beginning only now to realize how seriously their health may be threatened by the unchecked spread of new infections in the tropics. A worldwide network of regional research centers and early warning stations at the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars a year, out of a total U.S. medical bill of over $690 billion, would be a bargain if it could intercept a single new infection in time to develop strategies, vaccines, and therapies. Even within the United States, early recognition can save countless lives. As far back as 1976, there were hundreds of new cases of a rare respiratory infection otherwise occurring only in organ transplant patients taking immunosuppressant drugs. The infectious disease specialist, Dr. Robert T. Schooley, argues that with an advanced warning system, AIDS could probably have been detected by 1977 or 1978. In the longer run, the evolutionary biologist Paul Ewald has suggested a new strategy in the campaign against AIDS and other viral diseases, taming viruses instead of trying to eradicate them. Viruses naturally become less virulent as they co-evolve with their hosts, not only because killing all hosts would simultaneously destroy the last viruses, but because making toxins takes precious energy. Other things being equal, benign strains have a competitive advantage that will assert itself in time. Why has virulence, then, sometimes increased? Rapid changes of sexual partners and spread of the virus by intravenous needles make it unnecessary for the virus to spare the host in order to reproduce. In West Africa, where family structures are largely intact, HIV-2 kills less quickly than HIV-1 does in East Africa. Significantly, in monogamous Islamic Senegal, there is a low rate of progression to full-blown AIDS. The rapid rate of change of AIDS antigens creates daunting obstacles for both antiviral therapies and vaccines. Altering behavior to lower the virus's transmission rate will not eliminate HIV, but it can help domesticate it. A less mobile virus can't afford to kill its host. Blocking transmission not only prevents disease, but provides an evolutionary bonus, a shift to less deadly forms. If the conditions are right, mild and even harmless viruses may finish first. There are even some grounds for hope about chronic illness itself. Peptic ulcers, long thought to be the bodily expression of stressed executive living, may be the work of treatable bacteria. Real evidence for risk factors in any chronic disease must be epidemiological, not experimental. The negative side of relying on statistics is what Lewis Thomas called an epidemic of apprehension, of alarms about nutritional and environmental risks. But skepticism is not nihilism. It is a call for more rigorous statistics, even if people can't be assigned at random to vary their occupations, diets, and smoking and drinking habits. The lesson from randomized trials can help scientists develop more effective ways to judge the quality of epidemiological data. An important item of good news is that radical changes in diet are not necessary to reduce the risk of cancer, arterial disease, and stroke significantly. The prevalence of chronic problems is the dark side of stunning improvements that nobody would want to reverse. But chronic illness contradicts at least one dream of advanced technology. Despite all of the technology available to help people with disabilities, many conditions demand large blocks of time for unautomated human care. Even advanced rehabilitation equipment needs skilled operators. Most of the burden of daily care falls on spouses, adult children, and parents. Medicine stands accused of shifting human responsibility for health to chemicals and machines. Of course, it sometimes does just that, especially in the last weeks and months of life. But more often than not, it does just the opposite. Far from automating health, medicine, for better or worse, throws more and more responsibility on routine performance by states, families, and individuals. Tuberculosis is resurging in the United States only in part because drugs suddenly lost their effectiveness. Its return is also due to the reversal of a historic rise of urban living standards and to the related neglect of the day-to-day work of detection and treatment. Health promotion also demands routines that can't be automated, from aerobic exercise to dental flossing to hand washing by health workers. With no vaccine in sight for the near future, the prevention of AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases also depends on repeated use of mechanical barriers. Even an innocent walk through the woods now seems to require self-examination for tick bites. Automobiles, typewriters, and wristwatches may need less scheduled maintenance. We need more.